Everyone, can we pick up again?
Oh, I'm introducing.
As always happens in academia, 10 minutes become 20. It happens in publishing too, doesn't it, Martha? You're going to miss the best parts, everyone. Not the easiest thing in the world.
One, two, three.
You must know some of the people down in the harbor, the cast people down there.
Oh, yeah.
Let's pick up again. There's great stuff to talk about. For our next session, it's a brief one. I'd like to introduce the moderator. Doug, is it Doug Booby? Doug Booby. Is an associate professor of history here at MSU and graduate director of that department. His books include Black History, Old School Black Historians and the Hip Hop Generation, The Early Black History Movement, Carter G. Woodson and Lorenzo Johnson, and African American History Reconsidered. As the principal investigator for the Carter G. Woodson Home, his current project is the historic resource study entitled Willing to Sacrifice, Carter G. Woodson, the Father of Black History, and the Carter G. Woodson Home. Professor Deppert.
Thank you very much. Good late morning, I suppose. As was said, my name is Pero Dagbovi. I am an associate professor and graduate director in the Department of History here at MSU. And it is truly my great pleasure to be participating in this symposium on Sandra Seton's new play, Music History. And it seems that time flies very quickly. I remember when Sandra approached me, seems like 4 or 5 months ago, asking if I'd participate, and I just haphazardly said, sure. And then I received an email earlier this week reminding me, and I'd almost forgotten. So time flies and I'm happy to be here. I read the September 2010 draft of the play and saw the play last night. I've known Sandra and Jim for about 15 years. In fact, we're close neighbors in the Bailey community. I respect Sandra as a playwright, intellectual, and person. I thoroughly enjoyed Music History. I was truly moved by the production. As a historian who specializes in Black history, I appreciate plays and films that serve as useful windows into the African-American historical experience for millennial learners. And Music History is indeed successful in portraying numerous important topics in Black history. In addition to exposing us to the sacrificial life of a 24-year-old committed SNCC activist with Walter, and the maturity, independence, intelligence, strength, and understandable naivete of a 19-year-old Etta, Sandra delves into a host of important themes in African-American history and culture during a peak of the modern civil rights movement, including non-dysfunctional young Black love, generational conflicts, notions of respectability for young Black women, Black sorority and fraternity culture, the development of young African Americans' consciousness, social responsibility, racial profiling and segregation, anti-Black violence, and class and intra-racial divisions. Sandra's interpretation of her play's historicism is instructive. In her playwright's note, she insightfully observes, quote, "No person holds the rights to the story about the African-American experience. If anyone leaves this play and feels they now understand the Black community, think again. Music History presents one of the many stories about a multi-layered, dense, and complicated community. It is my hope that Music History provides a glimpse of African-American life that will add to and enrich the understanding and perspective of all members of the audience," end quote. And I would just like to speak on my own behalf and say that after leaving last night's play, I was thinking about it a whole lot. It hit me in many different ways. I sympathized with Etta and Walter in particular, and placed Walter within the context of those quote-unquote sacrificial lambs of the struggle. So, Sandra, you definitely had me as a member of the audience impacted by this, and I wish I was teaching my big survey so I could require all of my students to come see the play. Let me stop here, because after all, I'm just simply a moderator and not a presenter. This late morning and early afternoon, we have two presentations, Aaron Todd Douglas's Pillars and John Woodford's You Can Learn More in College Than What They Plan to Teach You. After I briefly introduce the two panelists, each speaker will present for between 15 and 20 minutes, after which I will initiate a brief question and answer session for about 10 minutes. Is Aaron Douglas here? Great. I'm going to introduce the speakers. Aaron Todd Douglas is a freelance actor, director, and part-time faculty member at Loyola University in Chicago. Originally from Cincinnati, Ohio, he earned his MFA from the University of Illinois at Champaign-Urbana, so I'm sure he could relate to the depiction of Champaign-Urbana in the play, and a BS from Eastern Michigan University. Aaron is a founding ensemble member of Congo Square Theater Company. Upcoming director projects include The Nativity, a Congo Square Goodman Theater production, and Radio Golf, Raven Theater. Recent directing projects include 12 Angry Men, The Brother-Sister Plays, Synergy, The Hip Hop Project, Insight into a Generation, and They Said I Wouldn't Make It, and Year of the Tiger. Aaron is also an accomplished actor, having worked extensively throughout the Chicago area in a wide range of productions. Further, he has served in seemingly countless other capacities, from casting director to production manager to assistant technical director to fight choreographer for dozens of other shows with Congo Square and the Cincinnati Shakespeare Festival. Our other presenter this morning slash afternoon is John Woodford. He was born in Chicago in 1941, but his family soon moved to Benton Harbor, Michigan after his father finished military duty as a flight surgeon in Tuskegee, Alabama. And we had some reference to Tuskegee, Alabama in the play last night. Woodford went to Harvard University, where he earned a BA, magna cum laude, and MA in English literature. In 1964, he was in Mississippi Freedom Summer, where he taught in Tougaloo College Summer School. He and his wife, Elizabeth Duffy Woodford, a college classmate, settled in Chicago after their marriage in 1965, and he began the first of two stints as a writer and editor at Johnson Publishing Company, which he sandwiched around his graduate education and a reporting job for the New Haven Register. In 1968, he returned to Ebony, which was also referenced in the play last night, but he later left to join the Muhammad Speaks newspaper, where he served as editor-in-chief from 1969 to 1972. He then worked as a copy editor and reporter at the Chicago Sun-Times till 1974, when he joined the New York Times National Desk as a copy editor. He left the Times in 1977 to work in publications for the Ford Motor Company. In 1980, he left Ford and was a staff writer for the Ann Arbor Observer before joining the University of Michigan as executive editor for Medical Campus Publications in 1981. He retired from U of M in 2005 after editing the alumni publication Michigan Today for 20 years. Woodford continues to contribute reviews and essays to the Black Scholar. He and his wife live in Ann Arbor. They have three children and four grandchildren. So I welcome you all to this morning, early afternoon's presentation, and we will begin with Aaron Todd Douglas.
Thank you, Pero. First off, I want to thank the MSU College of Law and Gabriel and of course Sandra, and forgive me if I sometimes lapse and call her Sandra. It just sounds so elegant to me, call her Sandra. I'm sad that we lost so many of our representatives from the law school. I was going to propose a project, a play idea with, you know, our professors, Professor Fletcher, Professor Kanacki were so entertaining, and I think that Professor Ray should of course film it, you know, turn it into a film. I'm going to talk about a few things with you all today. First off, I'm going to refer to Helen Keller a few times today. For some reason, her quotes seem to have particular resonance. Something about examining law and justice and the blind scales of justice. And also, she's just a brilliant writer. Optimism is the faith that leads to achievement. Nothing can be done without hope and confidence. And I believe that all art is based on this philosophy, this notion, whether the objective is to inspire or outrage, the hope and the faith that we can be moved by it still exists. Art is an optimistic leap of faith in most cases, even when it is a seemingly selfish endeavor. Sandra's work always possesses for me a great deal of wondrously practical optimism. This is perhaps the foundation of our friendship and mutual admiration. Sandra and I met some years ago at a panel discussion. She introduced herself to me in true Sandra charming and relentless fashion. And she told me of our mutual friendship with a mentor of mine, Kathy Perkins, who's a brilliant historian and designer in her own right, also a charming and relentless person. Almost instantly, we made this sort of leap of faith investment in one another, and I'm honored to call her a colleague and a friend. I'm from a progressive northern, sort of the demarcation of freedom, Cincinnati, Ohio. I attended a good public school, one of the best college prep public schools in the nation consistently, Walnut Hills High School. My mother went there in the 60s, and myself, my brother also went there, one of my brothers. And I'm often reminded of the fact that when she was there in school in the 60s, Negroes could only swim in the pool on Fridays, and then, of course, the pool would be drained and refilled before the next week, which would hardly be green by today's standards. Let me switch off and talk a little bit about Congo Square. I'm an actor and director. Congo Square Theater Company, just over 10 years ago, a group of like-minded theater professionals, read here, hungry and angry black actors, we decided to start a theater company in Chicago. We called it Congo Square as an homage to the historic district of New Orleans, if you're familiar with it, that is credited as being the birthplace of jazz and modern dance through the confluence of such cultures as French, Irish, Spanish, Indian, Caribbean, and African cultures to create something that's uniquely American. That sounds pretty optimistic and hopeful and confident. But anybody who's ever started a theater company would not hesitate to tell you that it's much like buying a boat. I used to bartend in this boater bar, and there were all these little boater quotes all over the walls, and one of which was, a boat is a hole in the water that you endlessly dump time and money into. And that pretty much describes the investment in Congo Square Theater Company. It's a labor of love, of course. It's a continuous source of pride and frustration. As you balance the needs of a bunch of egos of idealistic artists with the practical and harsh realities of trying to run a business, a self-sustaining business. The other nautical boat reference is the happiest day of your life is the day you buy your boat. The happiest day of your life is the day you sell your boat. All that notwithstanding, Congo Square is something that I'm very passionate about for many reasons. And when we as a company, or when I as a freelance artist sort of lose my way a little bit, excuse me, I try to refer back to our earliest inspirations and our motivations, the pillars, the foundations upon which I stand. One of which being August Wilson. He was a tremendous influence. Playwright, poet, giant. One of America's best, and certainly the preeminent black playwright this nation has ever produced. He was an advisor, patron, and a friend to Congo Square, and I was fortunate to get to speak with him and work with him, listen to him, smoke with him, and get to know him a little bit. But before that, he was an idol and an inspiration. When I was eager, young, angry, sponge of an undergrad and grad student. In fact, his piano lesson was one of the original reasons why I embarked on this path, or got sucked into it, as I like to think of it. In mid-90s, around 96, August delivered this monumental speech called The Ground on Which I Stand. And it challenged the establishment to, in essence, fund black theater. And then it sparked, you know, a whole bunch of debate, you know, these famous debates, this conflict with Robert Brustein, an artist, critic, artistic director, writer. And they went back and forth. And this, we're asked to choose, in essence, between Brustein's view that theater works best as a unifying rather than a segregating medium. And in true fashion, he reduced a complex issue into simplistic terms. Despite August's works, he remains the most produced black playwright in predominantly white Lord theaters, but he's pegged as a segregationist somehow. I'm not sure exactly how that works. The philosophy is sort of, can't we all get along, .. and preserve the status quo of 95% white guy theater? That's kind of what he was boiling it down to, and you know, I'm of course boiling it down myself for what suits me. But August's counter to the to Brustein's assertion that theater is a unifying rather than segregating medium, Mr. Wilson, his argument was that we cannot allow others to have authority over our cultural and spiritual products. Basically, fund black theater. And I'm greedy. I want it all. Why can't both of these things be true? I'm sure they can be true in our current, you know, post-racism America. That's what they're telling me. I'm not sure I'm buying that yet. Yes, of course, August's works could have used some judicious editing by traditional Euro-American theater standards. But hey, that's August's whole point. It's his work. It's specific to him and his stories and our stories, black and uniquely American stories. So these arguments were pretty much the ground on which I stand and we stood as we launched Congo Square Theater Company. August described himself as one who was fired in the kiln of the Black Power movement of the 60s. The ideas of self-determination, self-respect, and self-defense that governed his life in the 60s are just as valid and urging in 1996. And I gotta say, they're just as valid and urging in 2010, these many years later. In terms of economics and privilege, these are Mr. Wilson's words, one significant fact affects us all in the American theater. In 1996, it was 66 Lort Theaters, a league of resident theaters. And it's an organization made up of not-for-profit theaters in the country. Now there are 76. There's only one that can be considered black. It no longer operates at that level, Crossroads. From this, it could be falsely assumed that there aren't sufficient numbers of blacks working in the American theater to sustain and support more theaters. If you do not know, I will tell you that black theater in America is alive, it is vibrant, it is vital. It just isn't funded. And it's still sort of true today, but I do believe that black theater can be funded by its own merits, in its own rights, in, by, and near black communities, but as part of the fabric of America, it should also, of course, be represented at the Lort Theaters. I don't think we have to get reduced to such terms as assimilation versus self-determinism or sellout versus revolutionary. I think there's room at the table for all of these ideas. There are a couple other Helen Keller quotes that I kind of wanted to work in today. I'm only one, but still I'm one. I cannot do everything, but still I can do something. And because I cannot do everything, I will not refuse to do something that I can do. I think that's very appropriate as we look at Sandra's music history. And my pillars are based on the question of, what will you die for? Walter asked himself the question and answered it with his actions, unfortunately. But it's better phrased, I think. It can be posed, what will one live for? What will you live for? Young people like the college undergrads in the play, the men and the sorority sisters, they often view it in terms of death, in spite of that youthful sense of immortality. Perhaps because of their relationship with mortality, perhaps because in the setting of music history, death itself was such a tangible, looming, imminent presence. I'm afforded the luxury of asking myself, what will I live for? Because of the sacrifices that were made, that I try my best not to take them for granted. First generation post Jim Crow era, it's kind of a luxury that I can do something like study theater for a living with some reasonable expectation of success. I return often to the idea of, what will I live for? I have two young, very young daughters, 4 years and 2 months old. And it's important that I re-examine what I stand for as I attempt to raise these two brilliant and challenging young citizens. It's important to me. I'm gratified to continue to learn that my personal and my career artistic goals sort of remain in line with one another on the same path. The characters in music history are all clearly believers in the philosophy, though their patterns and their paths to the development of character are divergent. The philosophy, and this is another Helen Keller quote, character cannot be developed in ease and quiet. Only through experiences of trial and suffering can the soul be strengthened, vision cleared, ambition inspired, and success achieved. And I know there's been a lot of AKAs running around today, and maybe you didn't use that quote, but it seems like that's what those young girls were working on as they went through their pledge process. My four pillars being liberty, personal and artistic, equity, social and artistic, responsibility, personal and civic, and legacy. I spoke of the personal freedoms that I'm afforded because of the sacrifices of these characters and in the play and people like Sandra and many of you who've paved the way. Artistically, I reserve the right as an artist to be selfish at times, to produce art for art's sake, or art with an agenda. I love working on different works such as 12 Angry Men, which is still vital despite, 30 years of Law and Order. But it was pretty groundbreaking at the time. I mean, it was very groundbreaking, and it still resonates very well with our audiences. And Sandra and Jim were kind enough to come down, and I was honored that they did. To some of the other things I've been involved in, Smash Hit is a hip-hop play I've been working on with the author from its development stages. It's an examination of hip-hop as well as a PTSD, returning soldiers from Iraq and Afghanistan. And, every now and then you gotta break off and do some wacky interpretation of Midsummer Night's Dream every now and then, just for the sake of it, just for the sake of art. I like having that freedom. Equity. I'm a little wacky. I often irritate people that are around me because of how I want to play by the rules. I think everybody should play by the rules. We live in a society, a civilization. There are rules there for a reason. If you drive on the right side of the street, why can't we walk on the right side of the sidewalk? Does that descend into chaos? I believe in these things, this social idea of justice and equity and fairness. Artistically, one of the goals of Congo Square Theater Company is to create opportunities, similar opportunities for artists of color. It has been asserted in the press, there was a raging debate for a while about why there's not more people of color on Chicago's stages in a city like Chicago, one of the more diverse in the country, in the world even. Why are things still so segregated in the arts? I wish I had good answers, but they're all bad answers. And then when there are opportunities, you will find that the people of color aren't quite as sharp as their counterparts on the other side of the fence because they haven't had as many repetitions, they haven't had as many opportunities. So you're talking one, two, or three times on the stage per year versus their counterparts who get five or six go-rounds on the stage. It's just a simple numbers game. So one of the goals in founding Congo Square and one of my life goals is to sort of balance that out, create opportunities, well, you know, selfishly for myself, of course, but also for my fellow theater practitioners. Responsibility is a third pillar. I'm pretty old-fashioned. I didn't know that until, you know, I got out of school and took on more responsibility, stopped smoking so much weed, things like that. I didn't realize how anal I am. I didn't realize how much I valued traditions and values that I got from my family, but also the Harlem Renaissance writers that I adored. I've always taken it to heart that I was supposed to reflect positively on my family and be a role model for the youth. I was the beneficiary of a lot of older, experienced artists and professors who saw something and didn't hesitate to reach out or you know, smack me in the mouth, as the case may be, when I deserved it. And so, you know, now I take it on myself to reach that hand out or show the back of my hand when it's necessary to my young charges. You know, I think mentoring is something that we're all supposed to do. You're supposed to teach your craft in some way, shape, or form if you have a craft. It sounds old-fashioned, but the notion of be a credit to your race, you know, I haven't heard it for decades, but boy, it just sticks, you know, it just sticks when you read some of the writers that Ron, that you know, I've talked about over the past couple of days, you know, the Dudley Randalls and Claude McKays and Langston Hughes's and W.E.B. Du Bois. I think those things are important. That's a responsibility I have. Legacy. For me, this can be boiled down, and this is the final pillar, into a real simple phrase. Another one of my mentors, a dear friend, Ernest Perry, amazing actor, been around the block a few times. This guy's got more rodeos than him. But he worked an entire career while he was acting as a janitor. And he taught me shortly after I got to Chicago, you know, you come out of grad school and you think you're hot shit, but you're not. So you have to go through another whole finishing school once you get to the workplace. And he was one of my first professors in that last finishing school. Leave the place better than you found it. As a janitor, it was ingrained in him, but also as a person, no matter who you are, you know, you don't walk out of the room leaving your coffee cups laying around for somebody else to pick up, you know? There's nothing wrong with you busting your coffee cups and wiping off the table. And that's just one instance, but at every level, we should leave the place better than we found it. For me, it's as a son, a husband, a father, a neighbor, a citizen, and a global resident. That's my goal, is to improve what I've inherited. Lastly, I want to talk a little bit about the music of music history. Sandra has noted that music is a physical presence, and you know, you can expect that in a play called Music History. That's not off the wall. It's an additional character. And clearly, if you're familiar with some of Sandra's other work, she has a close emotional relationship to music. It's a vital component to her plays. It resonates. It is used so effectively, I can't help but to recall my own educational growth in music. And I thought about this as I read it, and I thought about it again last night as I was watching the play. Now, in my heart, I'm an optimistic, yet practical pessimist, but I am at heart an optimist. I'm an idealistic guy. I'm romantic. I have a soft spot for R&B and love songs. I do. The featured artists being people like Stevie Wonder and Marvin Gaye, Tina Turner, Luther Vandross, Anita Baker, Al Green, and one of my all-time favorites, Sade. Now, that having been said, that's a foundation for it. But you know, we all sort of grow through a musical awakening, more than one if you're lucky. My older brother Shad introduced me to new music at a time when it wasn't really all that popular to do so. We were pretty young, and he's playing Jimi Hendrix and you know, they weren't playing Jimi Hendrix on the radio at that time. And Bob Marley, and God help him, Motley Crue, and and Grateful Dead, and other stuff that became, you know, a gateway drug to a lot of other artists and different styles that I hadn't thought about before. You know, I'm talking like 10 years old and listening to this stuff, and you know, first I'm wrinkling up my nose, but after a while, you know, I'm singing Motley Crue right along with him. Well, let me change it. I'm singing Jimi Hendrix right along with him. Now, my dad, on the other hand, is a jazz man. And his influence, he introduced me to fusion artists like Spyro Gyra, and, as well as jazz vocalists. One of my fondest memories is listening to Lou Rawls on my dad's favorite radio station. As the sun went down, and it was, that's how long it was on the air, so at sundown. As the sun went down, they would play his rendition of the national anthem. And it was, man, every time I hear that, I still get goosebumps to this day. And of course, Lou Rawls was, you know, he was no slouch as an actor. And you know, generally, he was just one of the coolest guys on the planet. I miss Lou Rawls. And that kind of stuff became a gateway to Miles Davis, who was represented, you know, well in the play, and cats like Thelonious Monk and John Coltrane, and that sort of took me into artists like Louis Armstrong and Louis Jordan. And then I went down into some Gut Bucket, you know, some Bessie Smith, who I think Professor Ray mentioned that, and you know, some Lil Walter, Son House, one of my all-time favorites, Muddy Walters and Billie Holiday, those kind of artists. But I have to say that the performative music of my generation, very similar to how jazz was, you know, the devil's music by the older generation. Hip-hop, you know. I'm a hip-hop kid. I'm of a hip-hop generation. There, as much as R&B was the mainstay, you know, hip-hop came on in force and sort of took the world and is still sort of taking it. And the influential artists at the time being Run-DMC, and LL Cool J, who's still around, and Slick Rick, and Houdini. These were the storytellers. But the impactful ones were the socially conscious ones for me. These are artists such as KRS-One, and Poor Righteous Teachers, and a group called X-Clan, and other one of my favorites, you know, Eric B. and Rakim, Grandmaster Flash, and of course, Public Enemy. And you know, we can't discount the so-called gangster rappers who were advocating in their own way. NWA and Ice Cube and Ice-T, long before they were playing, you know, police detectives and making family films, they were they were influential in a big way. They really called attention to what was going on in the hood, as it said. And I want to leave you with a quote from one of my theatrical influences. I had the pleasure of working with Tina Landau, who wrote the Viewpoints book. It's in sort of an acting system, acting philosophy. It adds tools to your tool bag as an actor and theater artist. The piece is called Do Not Wait. And I think it represents these young people very well in the play. Do not wait. Do not assume that you have to have some prescribed conditions to do your best work. Do not wait. Do not wait for enough time or money to accomplish what you think you have in mind. Work with what you have right now. Work with the people around you right now. Work with the architecture you see around you right now. Do not wait for what you assume is the appropriate stress-free environment in which to generate expression. Do not wait for maturity or insight or wisdom. Do not wait till you are sure that you know what you are doing. Do not wait. Do not wait until you have enough technique. What you do now, what you make of your present circumstances will determine the quality and scope of your future endeavors. And at the same time, this is where I have trouble, be patient. Thank you.
Hello, I'm happy to be here. Thank you, Sandra. Thank you, Professor Dotto, Sandra Rice, Dean Haworth, It's a pleasure to be here, to be up here from Ann Arbor. Yesterday when my wife Elizabeth and I were riding around the campus and the town a bit, we concluded that maybe we were the hayseeds, because this city is pretty darn nice. It seems a lot bigger than Ann Arbor, but not that I don't want to say anything against hayseeds, because we're also a proud hayseed. But I wondered, I'm another South Side Chicago native, though I grew up in Benton Harbor, and I wondered, is Champaign blacker than Urbana? I should have, Sandra, is Champaign thought of as lesser than Urbana in some sort of way or another? Because we used to always say Champaign, Urbana. And now I always hear Urbana, Champaign. That always sets up my antenna. There's something, you know.
It was always Champaign, Urbana.
Yeah.
Some districting thing. And they had to say
maybe suspicious.
Legally Urbana, Champaign.
Oh. So it's not. There's nothing devious about it. Maybe. I don't know. I wonder, because we used to always be Benton Harbor, St. Joe, and now I hear people saying St. Joe, Benton Harbor, and I know the reasons for that.
Ah,
okay.
And,
the defense.
Whole place was in Champaign.
I rest my case.
Yeah.
Well, anyway, this this tremendous play fills a lot of spaces of all sorts, not just the set, but the space of music and politics, philosophy, culture. It's such a linguistic practice. Everything is in this small play that anyone could, you know, want to find. And I guess fueled by my sort of anarchic soul, I found myself feeling like an embedded journalist, embedded in my past. So as the play was going on, I couldn't help it. Someone would say something, and I would write it down on my program. I did have another more formal paper about black movies I would like to see, but I'm going to save that and shelve that, because as someone noted about Tyler Perry and launching on that sort, so I had that kind of, I have one of those. But I found myself writing down as the play went on, and then when I went back, I looked and I saw I was responding to the resonance between Sandra's play and what her characters were going through, because I don't necessarily assume that Sandra had to be going through everything that her characters were going through, but and with my own college days, and which overlapped with hers, although I think I started college a few years before she did. But anyway, when I went back and I looked at everything I was writing down, and then I just sort of listed them, and I go through them, and now I'm going to maybe hop back and forth, but I sort of did it in the order. So first, we notice in the beginning where, as a high school student, she's mentioning Frank Yerby, Samuel Shellabarger, Frank Slaughter, Dumas, she mentions. And I was thinking, like in high school, back in those days, there was very little you say juicy part literature that high school kids would be likely to find, especially in the library. Later on, our character mentions Henry Miller, but that comes in college. And I could remember the same thing, some of those same big pot boiler books that Etta was reading, and I could remember going through these big adventures, historical romances, and, you know, we would look, you know, oh my God, a bodice was ripped, you know, that literally. And these other things that Etta responded to, I think we were, because they didn't have sex education in class, or usually not in most homes in those days. So these novels served quite a purpose. And then she goes to, you know, pretty soon there's Godzilla, and already her character is looking at America from a critical foreign perspective, which I think is connected almost with her music of the universe. I mean, we're turning the lens back on America. We're not assuming everything in America is great. Maybe a lot of things in America ought to be destroyed. Then West Side, South Side, There's a lot made of the difference. I can remember when I first moved to Chicago in 65 and lived there for a number of years. And this whole West Side, South Side, well, being from Benton Harbor, and my father was a doctor, so he knew a lot of doctors at the South Side, and we used to come back and forth quite a bit. It was only 90 minutes. And I never even heard of the West Side till I moved there. But after moving there, and you hear all of this, the South Side had all the culture, the this and the that, and the richer folks. But I think that Walter is right when he says there's not much difference, because by the time you get to the mid-60s, you have the Black Peace Stone Nation on the South Side marauding, and you got the Disciples on the West Side. And jumping ahead, but actually at Muhammad Speaks, the editor who preceded me, Richard Durham, is a great writer of plays and film scripts himself, worked with, Doug Andrews of the Disciples. He was trying to turn into a revolutionary because he thought we'd need to have some sort of person good in business, in organizing, but who had political consciousness. So he was trying to instill political consciousness in Doug Andrews, who used to come into the office and he'd be dressed like a businessman, but actually it turned out Doug Andrews was, like Jeff Fort, essentially more just of a thug and crook, but that was the dream. But that reminded me of that. This cutting labels out of clothes, I didn't know anyone who did that, but there was, I know at the University of Michigan, I can remember we had very few kids from Benton Harbor wind up at the University of Michigan. And one of them who did, I remember she was telling me that she got her clothes at Kmart. It was very cheap. She was frugal. She studied a lot. She went to a lot of brown bags. There would be no other black students, and she would always said they were in the dorms looking at soap operas. But they used to tease her about the underwear that had the Kmart label, and they were all the sorority type people. And she was able to give them back as good as they gave her. But that, you know, that goes on and is still going on. The Ebony magazine popped up with almost self-satirical article that Etta notes. She says the first black jet pilot from Oklahoma, you know. And having worked on Ebony, we had, that was a staple. We didn't have always just those kinds of articles, but we did have that type of article. Then there was the twist. And the, in the 60s when you were supposed to have gotten, I can't say all people of European backgrounds' hips got moving, because some of them were moving in various kinds of dances before, but there was certainly you see the Germans and Scandinavians in the movies of the 60s, you can see that the twist was thawing pelvic regions in such a way that they got them loose, you know. Then there are the black Greek societies, the circle of wagons, that kind of black nationalism that declares, as the student says to Etta, we're all you got, whether you like it or not. Others have commented on this kind of defensive, protective, survival-oriented national spirit. And I'll get back to that later. Then there's, of course, SNCC, and I'm going to get to that later, the Elks. That's another kind of solidarity. What I began to feel, sort of as Jeffrey Ray had commented about the psychic dynamic tension, that many of the things that are coming up in that the play brings up, they work like flip sides on records. And the flip sides, you know, there's A side, B side, but sometimes the B side's better than the A side. There's not, they're not opposites. If there's a contradiction, it's a dialectical contradiction. It's not anything that's one knocks out the other. But there are a lot of things in this play that I began to sense were working that way. So you're having two ideas or two tendencies are being entertained and held at once in your mind. And that is an interesting tension. It's quite a work of art, I think, that achieves that. And she keeps doing it. The beatniks. So there we think, beatniks. It's mentioned in passing, but there we have the freedom seekers, the nonconformists. And she goes on to John Cage, on the other hand, Haydn, and Tchaikovsky. She's open to everything and both. The term grays for whites. Now, that's a regional, I think, term in that we never heard that in Benton Harbor or in Michigan that I knew of. However, when I went to college, it was my classmate from Springfield, Illinois, who introduced the rest of us to the term grays. We hadn't used that one. But that was then off-campus segregated housing. Those experiences that they had knocking on the doors, my classmates and I a couple times in Cambridge, Massachusetts. So it's not just that, it's not just Champaign-Urbana or that type of town with its southern flavor that had this problem, but twice as undergraduates we had to go to court, set up all sorts of things with the fair housing, you know, where you leap out, and then later when we got married we had to do it once in New Haven. Another bastion of great, you know, progressive, traditional American culture and law, observing the law, where you have to set up a dramatic incident where you get someone else to come to the house who's white, and they go and ask for the house that's available, and then you spring out, and then there's and you threaten them in the court. So these scenes, I had at least three of those scenes myself. I know they went on similar things in Ann Arbor. Then there are the parental expectations and ambitions, the pressure to conform and succeed, which are nurturing and supportive on the part of the parents. It's a natural sort of instinct, but then there's a, you know, there's the, it can be a smothering and a limiting emotion by the parents, as we saw with the, not only your play, but Raisin. The if you don't conform, you can't succeed is the idea. But the success might just be sheer survival in certain circumstances, and then it might be more of a petty bourgeois notion of success in other circumstances. So those two things going on at the same time. You know, Ed Sullivan, Rhapsody in Blue versus the music of the universe her mother liked to hear. Was Rhapsody in Blue the mother in the... Yeah, responded to well. Of course, Ed Sullivan, I won't go into that because I thought maybe there would be more young people. I won't go into the Ed Sullivan. But then there's the phrase a few times, the captain of the ship. You're the captain of the ship. And unspoken there, you hear the Henley poem, you know, you're the captain, I'm the captain of my soul. And it, she sort of doesn't even need to bring it out. It's just sort of there because the way it's used and emphasized by its repetition, you feel Etta's drive without us having to be, as people said, preached at you right in the open, right out, overtly. The links, the cotillions, and the essential notion of that freedom equates with whiteness. If you're trying to be free, you're trying to be white. Probably the most damaging absorption of racist ideology that black people have ever had, because you know it's the same as the notion that if you are trying to desegregate and you're trying to assimilate, these things get jammed together. They're not the same thing. And I think that's why Leroy Jones Baraka actually does evolve from his the sickness that he had when the notion was that if he was, you know, an excellent cultural figure, he was somehow selling out his blackness. He went beyond that, but I think the play catches him in it. And I will say that once in the Chicago L, there was one young white woman on the L, and almost all the rest of the passengers were black. And some crazy, psycho, you know, paranoid, schizo, abused her verbally, just pretty much the way he only, you know, he didn't know her. And I know the other guys, we were looking, we didn't know whether, he didn't touch her. We had decided that if he actually assaulted her, we would have to grab him, but we kind of felt guilty at the same time as not trying to stop him, but he was obviously a maniac, and if three or four people would have had to jump him at the same time. But anyway, I will say I saw in Chicago a scene quite like that. The other thing that was said to her was one time is, do you know who you are? You can't leave. And this notion of an identity that's imprinted, that you're sentenced to or condemned to. We're all you got, whether you like it or not. And of course, it seems negative, but then when she goes out to the landlady, you get that, you know, what are you? Foreign? Are you a foreign? You're an Indian? And that reminded me of the incidents, you know, in the South where black college students, especially in the 40s and early 50s, some would get in African robes. They wanted to eat someplace or stay someplace, and the people would say, you know, what are you? You know, I'm Ghanaian. Well, all right, you know. And as a matter of fact, I know my one of my cousins from Kalamazoo was reporting. There are two incidents, but one, a dentist, just like his father in Benton Harbor, a black dentist. He worked in St. Joe, so he had a lot of white patients, almost all white patients. He's a very fair skin, but at one time, his patients finally saying to him, what are you, hey, what are you, doc? You know, I've heard people say a lot of stuff about what you are. He said, well, I'm kind of part Indian and part Irish and I'm part Scotch and I'm part, African. I might say I'm a conglomerate. Oh, a conglomerate, the guy said. I knew you wasn't no nigger. I told them you weren't a nigger. Well, anyway, that's really real. So, but there's that challenging statement of how do you know about Philip Roth, which is sort of a flip of the same thing. That is a restatement of that challenge to the identity of the black person who's not going to be pigeonholed. I do wonder what it is about Philip Roth. I hope someone will have to get into that at some point. But the challenge is you act as if your mind is free, so it must mean that you think you're white. Then we get to the role of the women, which is mentioned in the South. First, we have the women in the civil rights movement. We hear a description of their role as menial, essentially, by Etta seems to presume that they are just the handmaidens of the males. But later on, of course, we get through Walter the description of the mother who is studying to pass the test and the daughter who is tortured and terrorized by the establishment. On the other hand, though he relates that, Walter, in talking to Etta, expresses a kind of male chauvinism of the kind we used to hear from the Panther Party, or Ella Baker, of course, noted that SCLC had some of the same chauvinist, misogynist tendencies, actions, behavior. Then trips to the South. And the famous trip, he's saving gas or leaving gas. I can remember first going to the South in the late 40s or 50s. My parents never told us at the time why we were driving, you know, the way we were and not staying in hotels. You know, you stayed with families. We were heading to Mexico, I think. But later I did get to go to Tuskegee when I was in high school. And at that time, the kids in Tuskegee said, we couldn't sit up. We had to sit in a certain place in the movie theater. So we didn't go, so we didn't actually experience it. But before I went to college, I happened to see two of my white high school friends in Washington, D.C. when we were visiting, and we decided to go to the amusement park. It was luckily for me to experience that, because otherwise I would have been even more naive when I got to college than I was. But we couldn't go into the amusement park, and we did the regular, are you good? Is this the United States of America? All that kind of stuff. But we didn't go. But luckily then when I got to college, I was more sensitive to what was going on. And my roommate from North Carolina, we had 16 black students at Harvard then in one class. Before that was only 2 to 3 per year. But we were part of some kind of experiment in which they added a whole bunch of kids from the South. And again, there's this knowing that you were being looked at and defined by some kind of outside force, but they swelled it to 16. You know, it was probably not even 1%, but it seemed like a lot. We all knew each other, got to know each other quite well. But anyway, my roommate, Travis Williams from Durham, introduced me to what was going on in North Carolina with Robert Williams and Negroes with Guns. It was a very exciting introduction to what was going on there. Then came the Woolworths boycotts. Now, Travis and I must say, no other members of our class participated in the picketing, but we picketed the Woolworths and did things of that sort. Later, when I was near graduating, I went to Mississippi in 64, and it was at Tougaloo when the three civil rights workers got killed, and we went on from there. Now, I wanted to mention when I got to college, probably similar to them, I can remember that during orientation, there used to be a sort of a gantlet of organizations. Okay, gantlet. You know, every organization would try to sign up freshmen to join this and that. I was intrigued by the World Federalist and the Sane Nuclear Policy. I don't know why. I had never thought too much about either thing, but then I was. And I can remember a fellow classmate said to me from Minnesota, he said, "My parents told me that they're going to try to do this when we get here, but don't sign anything. Don't join anything. Don't sign anything." He was a Scandinavian German from Minnesota that he said. And some others said, yeah, you know, they've got all sorts of people here trying to get you into stuff. Well, I did sign up for that. I didn't go to many meetings because it just didn't bother, but I did sign up for all those sorts of things. We then became to be studied by a fellow classmate who was in David Reisman seminar, and he got Reisman and what's his name, Senator Moynihan. He's going to study the 16 of us. At one time, they first called it Shadows in the Yard. You know. So. This study is now being kind of unearthed because one of my classmates who's a black filmmaker is trying to get someone to do a TV documentary because we've got the study and we've got the whole goods on what was going on. We want to expose it. I'm reminded in the housing too, speaking of Illinois, that my father knew Dr. Percy Julian, who was in a western suburb of Chicago. And I remember he called my dad one night. My dad didn't get over there. I wish he had. But he said, "I need people with guns to stake out my house because..." Now, Percy Julian, of course, is a brilliant medical researcher. But he had moved a little bit farther west. Well, I can't remember the name of that suburb. Maybe you know. It was a blood... so you could store blood, right? Plasma, something. I don't know that. I can't remember. I did at one time, but anyway, it was big. Anyway, he had to get out and defend his house with his guns, and he let them know what would happen if they tried to do anything about it. Later on, of course, the Vietnam War was brewing. And at college, since I didn't always just, we were involved in many things, but the anti-Vietnam War movement got quite big, and I can remember that I had friends who were in the National Student Association, which was very strong at Michigan State, by the way, NSA, I can't remember, I think, was Clifton Horton here then? When was he here? Anyway, they had a whole CIA, they had a lot of students working for the CIA, essentially. Not just at Michigan State, but the whole National Student Association was riddled with students who were being enlisted to spy, as later on, you know, a lot of anthropologists were enlisted to spy. But I can remember that the guy, he didn't know at the time, Duncan Kennedy, later became a law professor at Harvard. What he saw was that there were a lot more Americans over there, and they were doing a lot more than just advising. So when it came time for the Army to try to get me in 1965, fortunately, I had a battery of ways to answer to questions, like, you know, you might shoot your officers, you might this, you might that. I had serious asthma, but I was also ready. I would be a Canadian now if they had not given me a 1Y. And sometimes I wish they had tried to get me more and more, you know. I wish they had. Ebony, one thing about Ebony, with the, you were talking about the assassination of JFK, someone was, and when I went to work for Ebony, we had a special issue. We turned it over. We called it the white problem in America. Yeah. Yeah, yeah. I don't know, the white hate groups. Oh, you do? Oh, okay. You can see, because we had the same thing of, I can't remember how, you know, murmur and rumor, fearing that it was a black person who had done it and what that might mean. It reminded me of that quite a bit. Now, as far as Muhammad Speaks goes, I do want to put in a plug for the Michigan State University is bringing out an anthology called Voices from the Underground. Martha Bates is a principal person who is bringing it into being in Michigan State, and that has my Muhammad Speaks memoir in it. And so I'm very happy to be here for that reason too, because hardly any other publisher, I've been trying to get this thing published properly for 15 or 20 years, but it has not just black press, it has early American Indian, you know, Asian, Hispanic, gay, lesbian, all sorts of the range of so-called underground or alternative media from the 60s and 70s, as people talking about the the formation of their papers and the principles of their papers. I'm hoping that maybe it will lead to re-energizing of print journalism, because I don't think this online journalism is going to do it. Let me just jump to end here. When I noted the use of what did I say? It seemed to be a proper kind of anthem. I can remember that going to the, what did I say was sort of like a bombshell in radio mass culture, because it was put on the regular stations and people just couldn't, it was so infectious that I think it more than anything else sort of battered down whatever walls there were then between a gut bucket, because everything, I can remember a Chicagoan accused me of liking gut bucket music, and usually I didn't even know what he meant. He said, "Oh, you like that gut bucket stuff." He was, and he was another writer of Muhammad Speaks, wound up committing suicide. You know, I guess he liked another kind of music. You like that wrong kind of music, do it. So I wanted to just close on a note that what did I say is asking a very important question, which is, what did we say? What are we going to say? And Sandra has shown us, how to say. Oh, other people can't show it, we can't do it the way you did it. But let's just hope that other people will keep saying and not be limited by any prescriptive, limiting notions of what it means to be free or what it means to be black. That's it for me. Thank you. Thank you.
Any questions or comments from the floor?
No, I just had two questions, let's see if I can remember them now. I think you answered the one about the ebony issue. What year was that issue?
65.
And I worry so much about those hard copies of Ebony being lost. When I went over to the MSU library, I think I couldn't find anything from 63 or 64. Yeah, they were missing.
Really?
And I don't know where they are. And just about Aaron Todd, if you could just mention the plays that you've, I know you premiered the role of, it was Stick Fly, Lydia Diamond's play. You was it Flip? Was that just? You want to just tell us a little bit about your work in theater? You know, some of the roles you've done there, and that's all.
Sure. Yes, the character was Flip. We were talking about that. Ron was talking about studying black writers in Chicago, and I mentioned that Lydia Diamond might be a good counterpoint or bookend to Lorraine Hansberry. A few years ago, she wrote this play that we premiered at Congo Square called Stick Fly, which centers on an African-American affluent and intellectual family, and it's set in Martha's Vineyard. And you know, a lot of skeletons come flying out of the closets, as well as examining such themes as intellectualism, you know, infidelity, having children out of wedlock, and sort of as an afterthought, you know, my character Flip, the womanizing plastic surgeon, brings home a white girl to the family abode, and that wasn't really that much of a big deal for the family at all, you know. But the plays have been done around town, around the country, actually. It's been doing pretty well over the past, say, 3 years, I think it was. We premiered it in 2007. And that was one of the... We also premiered a work by... We talked a lot about Entezaki Shange today. It was a professional premiere of a play of hers called Layla's Dream. And I got the chance to... I was talking to Jeffrey about this, but I got a chance to speak with Entezaki Shange herself, and I was the Chuck Smith's assistant director, so I got to call her and ask her specific questions. I mean, she's brilliant. She's, you know, borderline other things, but definitely borderline brilliant. And and there's so many references, literary and musically speaking, that, you know, that were just way over our heads. You know, we had to do a lot of research, and some of it was even too obscure to find and research. And it was just easier just to ask her. So that was quite a treat and an experience and a learning process. But that was a lot of fun. Latest Dream.
You did a reading of my play, The Bridge Party. Did you want to mention that? We didn't mention that.
I enjoyed that. The Bridge Party, and we did a stage reading for the American Bridge Association, yes? In Milwaukee. It was sort of a deluxe staged reading because, you know, we had movement and blocking and lightweight props. But, you know, we rehearsed it on the fly in my living room and performed it in Milwaukee, and it was very well received, and it'd be nice to do a full-fledged production of more of your stuff. I look forward to many collaborations, and I have to say that it is a joy to, you know, talk about you and intersperse you and your work without missing a beat, you know, with such giant writers as August Wilson and Lorraine Hansberry and Entezaki Shange. So that's pretty good company. Pretty good company for them and for you.
Can I just ask one more? You talked about that A-B side. That was so interesting. I never thought of that. Did you have anything else to say about that A-B?
Well, I had more of them. I mean, I had, you know, Walter and Frank, but also Grand Ole Opry and Randy, which, you know, it was interesting because there was, in the 60s, for a while, there was really getting to be not a lot of lines drawn. I mean, lines were disappearing between the kinds of music that people liked and could hear. I think they got redrawn for not just marketing, but I think everything's being done to keep, you might say, a rainbow type or a pluralistic, conscious, pluralistic political movement with goals and principles from forming in the country, because that would be the only kind of formation that could alter this notion of corporations as having the rights of people. I mean, it'll take a huge movement because there's been such a retreat. I mean, Bakke was seen as a defensive affirmative action in a way, but it was really a retreat. It was the first step in getting knocked back, because they knew that they didn't want racism to be brought into the case as a reason for desegregating or for affirmative action. Past history, they wiped it out with the Bakke seeming to concede something, but then once you knock that out, you're forever pushed back. So I think with the music, with the Grand Ole Opry and the Randys, yeah, we used to do the same thing. We'd wait, Randy, we could hear after a certain night, that would come on, and we could hear Randy at night. Same with Del Rio, Texas. We could get that late at night. People used to drive around and go out and just drive around in their cars because you couldn't get it in the house a lot.
It's such a big thing.
Yeah.
Randy's.
Yeah.
College, you'd be there at night.
Yeah.
You'd find Randy, you could. Like Lightning Hopkins.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so in one sense, the same as some of these things that are protective and are things that nurture us, the Randys and the music, but on the other hand, his big sponsor, of course, is the White Rose Petroleum Jelly, which is a counter an anti-black kind of phenomenon. Yeah, White Rose Petroleum Jelly, so you got all this good, greasy hair to be encouraging.
I remember what a shock it was when Ray Charles recorded country music.
Yeah.
I mean, that was a big deal at the time.
Yeah, it
that
was. It was.
And he was great at it.
He sure is.
We're kind of moving away from just thinking of just the Grand Ole Opry and this being not a black thing, because now we have the Carolina Chocolate
right.
Drops.
Mm-hmm.
Does anybody know the string band? It's a black string band. You know the Carolina Chocolate Drops?
They reconstructed.
They're great.
Yeah, they are.
They were here in East Lansing two summers.
Yep. Yeah, we saw them in Ann Arbor too. They are reviving, reconstructing black, what would have been thought of as white. They thought it was white only. But it wasn't the music.
But in your play,
you
bridge.
Call it bluegrass and that sort of a thing, the banjos. They're a tremendous group.
Mm-hmm. But in your play, The Bridge Party, when they're talking about listening to the Grand Ole Opry there,
right.
And they're listening, who's the black?
D. Ford Bailey.
D. Ford Bailey was on the Grand Ole Opry back in the 40s, 30s
mm-hmm.
and 40s. So.
I think it's Chicago, WLS, mm-hmm. in the old days,
yeah.
used to play country music that, black kids and white kids, everyone listened also to that, to WLS.
Well, the question becomes, whose culture is this anyway?
Yeah, right.
And, if you go all the way back, and people will be tickled, but, you go back to Beethoven. Well, who was this Beethoven guy anyway? Was he black? Was he white? So if you start going back, then, mm-hmm. Find out some things.
I want to throw in the funding issue. And I don't really have a question, but I just want to put it out there because you brought it up, talking about black theater. And what's interesting to me is what art can be produced with little money, and what art can be produced what art needs a lot of money to be produced. Let me put it that way. And how that has influenced the development of art, the mixing, I don't know what to call it. We're talking about music right now and how music has crossed and done all these things, and it's one form that doesn't take the money that it takes to produce plays or to make films. And look at the development. I mean, it's amazing to look at the development of American music. and how it's allowed to be in these different spaces and how it, you know, so I'm just putting that out there as a topic for you two to comment on.
Well, well, everything could use some more money, but and you could produce most things on a smaller budget, but a lot of times, you know, money does affect quality. In the old saying, you get what you pay for, but you know, you can produce on a smaller scale. But for example, you know, as Sandra and I talk about some of her work and trying to get it produced, you know, the harsh realities come into play when we're going, you just got too many characters in that play, Sandra. We, you know, nobody's going to want to produce it, you know. But and when you talk about music, musicals are even more expensive because you have musicians to play, to pay rather, and they're even more expensive than actors. You can find cheap to free actors, you know, not of the best quality, but it's hard to find some cheap to free music musicians. It's, I mean, it's damn near impossible because they can get paid elsewhere, so they'll just not work for you and work for someone else where they can get paid. But musicals do tend to make more money than straight plays. So, you know, if you talk to theater producers, you know, everybody's trying to balance their theater so that they can serve their artistic mission, depending on what it is, with new works or straight plays or whatever. But a lot of times you tend to want to balance that with musicals because it'll keep your lights on.
Another issue imagery that I'm having is, as we're intergenerational, is, I mean, if I go to a play, if I go to a musical, I see a lot of people with dark roots. And so how do we cultivate our younger individuals to really understand how wonderful and innovative plays are in interjecting a lot of cultural information and history in a very entertaining way? And it's, you know, I mean, if you look around the room, I mean, it's, other than giving extra credit, it's extremely hard to get our young people to value that. Or what they see as entertainment has a tremendous amount of special effects to it. I mean, and that really makes the movie. It has nothing to do with the content. And if I talk to the young people, they'll say, oh, Dr. Clark, you got to go to such and such. And I'll say, well, tell me about the movie. Oh, well, but the
and they'll
graphics.
They'll tell you who was in it. They won't tell you about the movie. They'll tell you who was in it.
There's no substance to it. Yeah. And then there's a lot, and you know, and that plays out in their values. And so we've got a ways to go in cultivating that hunger.
Absolutely.
For culture.
And that's something that's close to the heart. I mean, and it goes back to, you know, we have to invest in the education of them. We have to get them early, hook them and keep them. Get them to participate as kids, to develop that appreciation, and then keep shoving it in their faces so that we can challenge and refine those tastes so that they're not satisfied with you know, the esteem Mr. Perry's work. That can't be the be-all, end-all. You know, we want to create a place for it, yes, because there are some, you know, inane comedies on the other side of the color fence, and I mean, there's a place for it, you know, but when it represents the entire culture, and that's a phenomenon that's just us, you know.
Can I add something to that? Yes. I'm pretty in tune with the hip-hop generation. It's the basis of a lot of my research. And I have three kids who are 14, 12, and 10. So I face this kind of on a daily basis. And I place the responsibility somewhat within the hands of the artist, him or herself, just as I would place the responsibility within a scholar's hands to motivate within young people the desire to even want to get into something as boring as history. And so I don't ask us to sell out and totally water it down, but I ask us as the older generation, that is, to, you know, meet them in a middle ground. And that's what I liked about Sandra's film, to be frank, and I'm not just saying this because we're friends and neighbors, but I think that it would really strike home for a lot of young black women. And that's one of the things that I loved about this play so much, is that it centered
black women's experiences in the 60s that's very relevant today. Sorority life has changed, we know that, but it's steeped in tradition. Any black woman who's in a sorority, has family members in a sorority, can relate to a lot of the real stuff that was taking place in that play. So it's about getting young people to take the step and go to these things at first, lure them in any which way we can con them, and then once they're there, they will appreciate it. And I was looking around last night, and the young folk who were there seemed to be really, you know, getting into it and appreciating it, and especially on certain scenes that they could all relate to that had kind of like a quote-unquote timelessness to it. So I ask us to meet our audience middle ground. I call it infiltration. That, you know, you act like you're down with it, you listen to their music, you tell them about Soulja Boy, and then you drop some heavy stuff on them, and they don't know what to do. You know, you got to do that. Because they're not going to be into stuff. And me and Jeff were talking about the problems with Tyler Perry and how everyone's going to line up, yet Spike Lee or somebody else pull out a film, you got to give away free tickets to get some people to see. And that's where Tyler Perry dropped the ball, is that he had the opportunity with his name and reputation to draw people in, yet kept it so dumbed down, as Lupe Fiasco would say, that, you know, people didn't get a whole much out of it. And I just want to say one more thing, and then I'm done. I want to praise playwright Seton for dealing with violence in the way that you did. As a historian, I'm really into exposing the underside of black history, even if it might get people upset. In my latest book, I published a chapter on African-American history and genocide. And when I turned it into the publisher, they're like, African-American history and genocide? What are you talking about? And the way you dealt with issues of violence, I thought, hit home. And particularly the sexploitation of black women. And that one description of the young woman who was assaulted reminded me of Fannie Lou Hamer. And I was just wondering if that was kind of a point of departure for you in that. But I appreciate that side of putting things in people's face to get it, you know, home. And there's a new book that just came out by Daniel McGuire called At the Dark End of the Street that's all about the sexualization and rape of black women during the 40s, 50s, and civil rights movement that your play kind of really contributes to.
Well, I've read a lot of, kind of ongoing, was very interested in reading a lot of histories of the civil rights movement, reading old newspapers, magazines. But then when I started to write the play, then I don't know any of that anymore. Okay, so I can't really talk about specific references because I have to lose everything that I read in a sense, and then I go back there and I have to live in that world as somebody who was there who wouldn't know the things I know now. So I know that that's all there, that the Fannie Lou Hamer and Medgar and just so many and Charles Sherrod, I mean all those early people and a lot of the guys that started SNCC and the women and a lot of people, but those people are part of our history now, but they weren't history then. Because it was right there at the moment. So you have to be very careful, because if you write with too much of the history in mind, then you bring so much baggage to what you're doing that the characters don't come alive.
I'm quick here. I'm sorry. I love the record thing, the A and the B side. Mm-hmm. I'm going to steal that and use it.
Okay, you'll do a better job.
Because I do remember one of the first records I brought, and again, showing some age here, was a record called Soul Finger by the Bar K's. And I just had to go get that thing, and my dad just laughed at me like crazy. And then within 2 weeks, I was playing the flip side, which was called Knucklehead. And he was saying, I thought you were loving Soul Finger. Oh, Soul Finger is so old. This is one that you want right here. I just thought that's just classic. Yeah. That is just really classic. And I also love this theme that you hit on just in terms of this questioning. And I think you can build a whole lot of art around this, just in terms of who are you, where are you going? You know, and it seems that it seems like it's a central question around Black identity within community and without community. And I was reminded of, there's a recent book, and I can't remember the name of the book nor the author, but she talks about, she covers three families that moved north and sometimes escaped north from sharecroppers' lives to lives in the north. And
is it Isabel Wilkerson's book?
I think it is. Isabel Wilkerson's book.
She used to work in Chicago when I was there, and New York Times.
And she talked about, that was one of the things that she talked about, at least with one of the families, you know, escaping sharecropping, and that question being asked directly, who do you think you are, where do you think you're going? You know, from sharecropper to class to intraracial, that kind of central question coming up over and over again in issues of Black identity, Black life, Black movement in this country. Mm-hmm. I just think that's a real central kind of theme, and also in very much so in Sondra's play, you know?
Mm-hmm. It's interesting that there are a lot of things that there are no movies about, and things, Professor White, that was illuminating. I'd never heard of that one. I've heard of a lot of other struggles that I've never heard of before, and I always wonder why weren't we taught all of this in school? But and you think of the images. I've been thinking of the image of the Black father holding his baby. Well, how counter that is to the baby being tossed out of the window. What the real people were like. And there are a lot of sharecropper. You know, Jose Hudson, the Black communist sharecropper organizer, has got his autobiography, which Robin Kelly has written about, Hammer to Hoe. I can't remember exactly what it is. Yeah. Hmm? Yeah. But I mean, these are stories that could be mined for great movies and plays. But you know, we don't see them. We have the longshoremen's resistance. We've got the uprisings at the forts in the South by the Black soldiers. And you know, there are many things that we don't see. And I think a lot of them we don't see when Black men are mad, angry, but not crazy. You know, they like it if they're crazy and going off. Even I think that's why I always Leroy, but I knew him as Leroy first. But anyway, Baraka, you know, he evolved from that. But if they're going crazy and they're going to do something suicidal or you know flip out and do a Bicker Thomas or whatever, these people become the icons even with among the literary set. And the other kind of person is kept away.
Yeah, well, I hear Zora Neale Hurston in my head talking about the Southern rural Blacks being pushed into the dustbin of history.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
In terms of it, the art becoming a very urban aesthetic, right? And so urban values and urban notions and urban settings, and so you don't hear much of the rural history, right?
No.
In terms of the artwork.
No, nor do you hear a lot.
Particularly in theater, right? You don't get, you know.
The throughout the South, there were the Black guys with guns whom the Klan and other people let alone from 1870s and 80s on, living in enclaves and armed, and they didn't bother them. They were able to use their guns, and they would do it. But again, that type person, I think there's a book now about this community in Mississippi that was some unusual type community, but they were just people known as they would call him a crazy nigger.
Winchester
Negroes. Yeah, you're right. And, but you don't, they don't mess with him.
I don't know, you know the cartoonist Ollie Harrington who did the Bootsy cartoons?
Mm-hmm.
Ollie's grandfather, he has this whole thing he tells, and I have it on tape actually, because his grandfather goes and cuts this guy down who's about to be lynched, and his name is Will Shoot Harrington.
Yeah.
It's just great.
Yeah.
And you just don't bother this dude. This is a bad dude. You leave him alone so he can go up and do stuff like that.
Yeah.
Did you want to say?
Just one thing. I would just like to compliment Professor Degbovi's concept of infiltration and confidence that people will respond. I required a class of mine to read The Bridge Party, and then Sandra came to the class. When they first looked at the play, they thought, look, they loved it. They loved it. They had a chance to identify. You said they would identify. They did. They identified with the young women. They identified with the problems. The discussions were brilliant, and then Sandra came to the class. So sometimes we have to infiltrate, like you're saying.
Thank you. Thank all the speakers. I want to thank everyone. I think this morning's symposium was very exciting. Heard a lot of interesting ideas. I'm sorry that some of the people had to leave to other commitments, but thank you as well for the questions. And thank you for being. Now, this afternoon's roundtable is something for insiders, as it were, but all of you are insiders in this. It will be a discussion. It will be a discussion with directors, the playwright, and actors, all at the same time.
See you here too. Thank you.
There's an abundance of food.
No, I think it's that.